Welcome to the Association Special Edition on Disability in COVID-19 Conversations. I am Samantha Nusack, and with me is my co-editor, Dr. Marnie Brown. And today we're going to be talking about some of the issues that you can find in the pages of this special issue, as well as some other thoughts on disability, COVID-19, and what that means for the field of sociology in general. To start though, Dr. Brown, if you would please introduce yourself.
Sure. Welcome, everybody. My name is Dr. Marnie Brown. I am an associate professor of sociology at Georgia Gwinnett College and currently serving as chair of faculty for the Human Development and Aging Services program at Georgia Gwinnett College.
Thank you. And I am Samantha Nusack, as stated. I'm a graduate student at Kent State University, currently working on finally finishing my PhD and getting out of school. I'm primarily interested in wellness, but I clearly sideline in the sociology of disability. And not with us today is Dr. Tiffany Taylor, our other co-editor. She also works at Kent State University, and her research interests are incredibly diverse, including the sociology of gender, sexuality, and more. She's an incredible mentor, and I'm going to just shout out a thank you to her for everything she did on this special edition.
So let's go ahead, and why don't we start with one of our first questions. Sam, maybe you'll take the first one. Does that sound all right?
Sounds good.
All right, so let's talk about the inspiration behind this special edition. And you have a lot to do with the inspiration behind this special edition.
I do. This is one of my course papers, incredibly broadened. So as COVID-19 kind of descended upon all of us, I began to think about how the symbolic nature of disability was really caught up in visible cues. And I wrote a course paper for Dr. Taylor exploring how symbolic inactionism would argue that we use these visible cues to kind of symbolically indicate, oh, this person is sick. And one of the things I was most interested with was, because I have an invisible disability myself, I found that nobody really cared when I was sickly in public before the pandemic. But during the pandemic, if I went out to get groceries, they all very clearly thought I had COVID. There was this visible, like, oh, you have the plague. And I kept thinking about that and thinking about that. And I had so much trouble on this course paper because I felt like there was too much to say. And Dr. Taylor had the boldness that I did not to suggest that this really should be an entire journal issue. She reached out to talk to you, and we all reached out to talk to Cameron Lippert, the editor of this journal. And the whole special issue came to be, which I still kind of can't believe.
I know, and I feel similar to you as someone who also has a chronic illness and oftentimes an invisible disability. COVID made dealing and managing with the chronic illness so much more difficult and made being out in public more challenging, and for folks that didn't usually recognize the disability, it all of a sudden became visible. And as soon as Dr. Taylor and you reached out to me, as someone who also doesn't generally study disability, but focuses more on gender and sexuality as well, I found this to be such an important subject for us to look at and take on the journal. Because as you and I have talked about, it's really important that we bring disability front and center. And the pandemic in many ways has forced us to do that.
On that note, maybe we should mention what our conditions are to provide a little bit of context for the listener.
Sure. Why don't you go first?
Yeah. So I have two primary conditions: postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS. It's a real mouthful when you sound all of the words out, and hypomobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Also a mouthful. I've learned that many health conditions are extremely long-winded. But in essence, my joints are very stretchy because my collagen does not hold me together very well, and my autonomic nervous system doesn't work properly. This means I am prone to fainting in public, which is awful. My blood pressure drops a lot. I get dizzy. I have trouble eating food. All of your basic functions don't work very well for me.
I have a rheumatological condition called ankylosing spondylitis, where my body overproduces inflammation. and it leads to bones and joints fusing together. This started to happen to me around the time that I was 30 years old. I had a stroke at the age of 30, and following the stroke, many other triggers began occurring in my body, including joint pain, rashes. I was also detected with POTS, as well as a hole in my heart, which led to a procedure where they covered it with a mesh patch. And here we are almost 14 years later, still dealing with ankylosing spondylitis, which occurred first in my jaw, where the jaw joints and bones fuse together. It's moved to other places in my spine. It does make mobility more challenging. It leads to fatigue and some other sometimes visible issues, but I'm fortunately at a place where it's managed. But I will say on a regular basis, I have procedures to deal with infections and managing the illness. I take biologics, which in many ways are kind of like chemo treatments. I do this once a week, as well as a larger one once a month, which lowers my immune system's ability to fight off infections, which is one of the reasons why COVID has been so dangerous in many ways. And it just makes it much more difficult to be with people, because most folks can fight off a typical cold or bug, and that often becomes very difficult for me.
Yeah, POTS is interesting in that regard too, because I'm actually very recently disabled. So I was fine pretty much until about 2.5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I actually was getting my diagnosis done during the pandemic. So I was diagnosed in the summer of 2020, and a lot of my medical experiences were shaped by what they could do during the pandemic while trying to not infect me, because one of the presumed causes of POTS, and what seems to be it in my case, is an overreaction to a viral infection. And what we're seeing in a lot of people who have long COVID is that they're developing very POTS-like symptoms. And there are a lot of discussions in the medical community that we might have a sudden absolute flux of POTS patients without any of the infrastructure to deal with it.
I think something interesting that both you and I share is I experienced my stroke while in graduate school. And it seems like you've experienced your onset of disability and illness as well while dealing with school. And for folks listening, I think many are probably in school or dealing with academia, quite possibly in some sorts. And it really does challenge or kind of force you to renegotiate how to be a sociologist, how to be an academic, because the disability becomes a full-time job.
Absolutely. I had my first year of my graduate program pretty healthy. Honestly, I was in shape. It was all good. It was going well. I worked out every week. And I fell ill really dramatically over the course of 3 weeks. And I had been sickly before. I've always been a sickly kid. But it went from, okay, this is something I can manage on the side. I just need to be a little careful about overexerting, very quickly into, oh God, do I have to drop out of school? And one of the things that struck me as I was falling into this is that I couldn't really find a whole lot of people talking about similar experiences. And the few people that I already knew from my first year of graduate school, nobody had experienced this that I had met. My peers were able-bodied. And I have a close friend who also has a chronic illness that happens to occurred to her about the same time, but it was very striking to realize that the sociology of disability just does not have a whole lot of literature. And I think that leads us pretty neatly into our second prompt, which is, how has COVID-19 made the sociology of disability more relevant?
Well, I think one of the things that we've noticed is COVID-19 has forced many of us to pause and think about how we go through our everyday activities, right? For many of us, work and school has changed. How we conduct these everyday practices don't look the same as they used to. So if we take that simple scenario, that the way that we go through our everyday, and apply that to the sociology of disability, all of a sudden we begin to see an expansion in what we think about disability. You and I have talked about, for folks that have experienced COVID-19, are we going to have more folks that are now disabled? And if so, how are we going to think about them, research this population, understand their experiences, and apply it to the way that we think about disability? Are we finally going to get to the point in sociology where we make disability and able-bodiedness a front and center social category in the way that we talk about our lived experiences, because the pandemic has changed the health of so many people? For many of us in sociology, whether we're teaching intro to sociology or more specific courses, disability tends to be a subject that's either taught in a week or it has, you know, a small chapter. But unless you're teaching a specific class on disability, like sociology of disability, it's not always a subject that's touched upon. I think, and I hope, that the pandemic is forcing us to think about it slightly differently and make health, wellness, able-bodiedness, disability more front and center to our work, and that sociology is going to add to the literature in general on disability.
Yeah. One of the other things I've really noticed is that people are starting to acknowledge the intersections that involve disability, because of course it does not exist in a vacuum. And we've got a couple of great articles in this special issue that touch on this intersectional nature. And for those of you who are interested in this, I'm just going to quickly shout out some articles for you. Tanya Cook's It's a Gift and a Curse, How COVID Reframed Our Understanding of Disability as an Intersectional Identity. The Invisibilities of Disability, Compiling Conversations by Heather Dilloway, Allison Gendry James, and Amanda Horn. Hidden Bodies, Queer Variant Ability, Intimacy, and COVID-19 by Emily Stevens and Stella Tarnoff. And Disfemnicide, Conceptualizing the Femnicides of Women and Girls with Disability. And I am so sorry to the authors immediately before I butcher their names, by Valerie Grandmaison and Edelweiss Murillo Lafont. Totally guessing on that. I'm so sorry. But my inability to pronounce things aside, there are a lot of different disability experiences. Both Dr. Brown and I are white women, and that's definitely influencing how people are perceiving us. I know for me, I am very much the embodiment of just this fragile, sickly thing, because I'm also very thin, and I don't seem threatening, I think is a good way to put it. And that's a very specific experience, but it also means that doctors tend to think that I'm over-exaggerating. So you have these very different experiences that come with these different identities, because people assume that your pain tolerance is different, your propensity for lying about your disability is different.
Yeah, Sam, and you saying that, I can't help but remember, after experiencing issues with my jaw, having the stroke, being diagnosed with the hole in the heart after this thing called a bubble test, going to see a well-known rheumatologist in the state that I live in, and waiting, you know, hours on end for him to come into the room, and within just a few minutes, looking at me as a white woman. At that time, seeming more frail, kind of bent over and hunched and uncomfortable. And he looked me straight in the eye and said, I think this is hormonal. I really don't think there's anything wrong with you. And feeling so small and not heard and not seen and not visible. And of course, you know, having the access to get to that appointment, being able to afford the appointment, I was already in a privileged place, but this one physician took so much away from me, and it took so long to get a diagnosis, to find a physician that was actually willing to listen and hear me and recognize that not all bodies present illnesses or diseases in the same way. To your point, the intersectionality of the way that our bodies experience disease and illness matters so much, in addition to the fact that medicine as an institution has been very exclusive. I think it's fair to say it's been quite whitewashed. It's been, most of the research historically has been done on male bodies. So if that's not what your body looks like or presents, it's not uncommon to be disregarded. And if you've had that experience, how awful it makes you feel and how difficult it can be to either get a diagnosis or get relief or, you know, get to a place where you can handle or work through what it is you're experiencing. It's unbelievably frustrating. I think for you and I, through our conversations, there's definitely been some hope. As awful as the pandemic has been, will it allow us to really bring very important issues of intersectionality and disability and health and wellness to the forefront in ways that it just hasn't been before? Will we begin to open our eyes to seeing what wellness and illness looks like in ways that we just haven't seen it before?
Yes, especially Dilloway, James, and Horn's article, The Invisibilities of Disability. I really felt, pun not intended, seen
yes.
by that article, because you spend all of this time, especially for those of us with these invisible conditions, because only about 2% of disabled individuals use a wheelchair. That is the symbol of disability, but it's very rare. And that leaves people totally missing the majority of experiences. And I've had doctors tell me I was just dieting. That's when I've gotten a lot. And plenty of instances where people don't understand these nuanced issues. Stevens and Tarnoff's queer variant ability article also hits close to home for me, because as a queer variant ability person, that is, these intersections aren't talked about, they aren't looked at. And I really look forward to this special issue making a little bit more of that conversation available, especially because, for those of you who don't know, this is open access. This is great for your classrooms.
That's right.
So consider assigning this.
That's right, Sam. One of the great things about working with Dr. Cameron Lippert on this piece and this particular issue with this journal is it's open access and peer reviewed. What a great combination to make these articles that you and I and Dr. Taylor feel so passionate about available to students, undergraduate and graduate, and of course, you know, faculty at our colleges and universities. This is such an important subject, and to go with this particular journal gives us an opportunity to make sure that the pieces have been reviewed, but to your point, are open access and available to those that are willing and want to read it.
Yeah, again, pun unintended, but it's very accessible.
Very accessible. All right, well, what if we talk a little bit about conversations around COVID-19 and health and disability and the way that they're shaped by capitalism, the way that they're shaped by this capitalist system that we're so embedded in. You and I have had some of these conversations before. You and I both know we can't talk about health and disability and not speak about capitalism. So maybe you can share a little bit about your thoughts about how COVID-19 and health and disability have been shaped by capitalism.
Yeah, so there are two pieces, I think, to this. The first is the one that I'm admittedly the most interested in, and that is health and disability are fundamentally defined by the economy. One of the things I've struggled the most with as I fell into very severe POTS from what used to be a pretty mild condition is, am I really disabled because I still work? That fine line between saying I'm disabled versus I'm chronically ill, both are true. I'm disabled in a logical sense of there are things I am not able to do, which was this initial conceptualization of disability. But when people are talking disabled, they generally mean you can't hold a full-time or even part-time job, which leaves a lot of health conditions that are often quite awful, considered not disabling, just because you can work. And that, I think, is such an interesting middle ground, especially right now with COVID. There are a lot of people who got sick and who are having long-term consequences of that illness, but they might not know if they count as disabled, because those are some pretty strict standards, especially if you're looking at how the government defines it to restrict access to benefits.
I think that's such a wonderful point for you to raise, especially as we think about work. And for those of us that work in academic settings, at public institutions, the way our public institutions over these past, you know, these past few COVID years, however we want to define that, have thought about who has access to virtual teaching and virtual meetings, who needs to be on campus. You know, I think in the beginning of the pandemic, there was an understanding around safety. And if you have the ability, if your job, right, and again, this speaks to kind of a privileged working situation in this economic place, if you have the ability to work from home, that seemed more favorable. But you and I both know there's not, when you look at the economy, it's actually not a lot of jobs that have the opportunity to work from home. Most of our work involves being out in a field of some sort. But for those of us in academia, there was an option to do some work from home, but not all the colleges and universities after some time kept that in place. And I found myself as somebody chronically ill and very nervous and apprehensive about being in public because of exposure to COVID-19, constantly having to apply for accommodations. And to your point, I am working. I don't look disabled, but the threat of the virus felt so great that it's like, how do I walk this line of needing accommodations, even though I don't look disabled, but now, right? So it became very confusing in a lot of ways, because some of these definitions, although I think as sociologists, we would argue are socially constructed, became difficult to make sense of because of the way they were defined by our, you know, our state and federal governments and the way our institutions were interpreting them. And then even the way the economy, to your point, would see it. What does it mean to be disabled and to be able to work? How do we take that into consideration with what you need to continue your job? And some folks are still dealing with this. And I think you and I both know that in terms of the economy, COVID has made it where some fields have really lost a lot of workers because we haven't been able to adjust to the needs. I think we're seeing this in healthcare and education, where there's been a real concern about how do we keep folks safe and supported during the pandemic, even though there's such a strain on the need of those workers because of our economic conditions.
Well, and some corporations at the same time are profiting off of this. So my fiance works for a to be unnamed Mail corporation, but Mail has made more money than ever, record profits. And I think this is also something that you can kind of see touched on in Older Black Workers' Resilience, Navigating Work and Health Risk with Chronic Conditions by Kendra Jason. So if you like this section of our conversation, that's the article for you. But the difference between my fiance's experiences and my experiences are night and day. The second COVID hit, we were kicked off of Kent State's campus, and I have not been required to go in since. They've been incredibly accommodating. Shout out to my department. Thank you. But my fiance, the mail has not stopped at all because it's an essential industry for whatever you're buying off of Amazon. And it's been an interesting thing to think about for me that if I was in her field, I wouldn't have been able to go to work at all. And even when my health took a turn for the worse, I would have been unemployed. Whereas in academia, I very luckily chose a field that allows me to keep working, even if I have to be horizontal the vast majority of the time. You can't lay down at most jobs, but I can. I can just put my laptop on my lap. For my fiance, she's starting to develop a lot of joint pain from moving these giant bags of mail. She's had to go in through the whole pandemic. And there were a lot of people at her facilities who have gotten sick, ourselves included, by the end of the pandemic. Thankfully, vaccines kept us safe. But they're making a lot of money off of making sure that people are still coming into work, because that's capitalism's priority, is trying to maximize profit.
That's right. Well said. I mean, with capitalism, it's generally profit over people. And the pandemic highlighted that more than anything else and really showed us how we treat essential workers and stratifying work, what type of work we value, what type of work we see as private and safe, and what type of work we're willing to, and workers more than anything, expose and have out in public. And of course, seeing the arbitrary nature around salaries and wages. I think that was really highlighted during the pandemic. And to your point, Kendra Jason's piece does a great job of exposing this, particularly in the work setting that she studied. But I think it's really important for us to kind of draw attention to the way many companies and corporations banked on the pandemic, while so many of us as workers and just members of society struggled through it. And I can't help but think about kids and children as well, you know, those that maybe couldn't work, but were still a part of the economy in other ways because of their participation in school or activities. It's really, really exposed so many of the cracks in our economic system.
So I'd like to pivot now to talk about what COVID-19 has changed about disability. I think we've been touching on that throughout this, but let's bring it to the forefront. What do you think has really changed with this pandemic?
I think something you and I have talked a lot about is accessibility, right? That's been a huge change due to the pandemic. I think one, our conversations, our public and private conversations about health and wellness have become much more accessible, for a lack of better terms. But we're seeing, whether through social media platforms or general media platforms, way more conversations about health and wellness. There's obviously been a push from federal and state governments to talk about COVID-19 and vaccines, masks. Of course, there's a counter to that as well, but there's just more public discourse around health and wellness and the pandemic. That creates an accessibility for folks around this material. I think it's also allowed us in a lot of ways to just think about what health means. And we've had some conversations about what does it mean to be well? What does it mean to be ill? I know you have a lot of interest in really understanding wellness. What does it mean to be mentally well? What does it mean to be physically well? I think we're beginning to understand a lot through capitalism that many of us in our society are not well. We manage and deal with symptoms all the time. I would even argue that so much of the way capitalism works tends to make us sick, right? The long hours, the quick food, the constant sitting, or if you're standing and on your feet, maybe it's not done properly or with the support. So then it does impact your joints and your muscles and your bones. So we don't necessarily live in a society that promotes a lot of wellness. We're having more conversation about that. And we are seeing some health practices begin to pivot towards a focus on wellness, but there is a lot of privilege around who can access that sort of wellness practice. I think accessibility around healthcare is also becoming more and more common in conversations in public discourse. I do want to give a shout out to some of the pieces in this particular part of the journal that get at this question of COVID-19 and disability. One, when a global pandemic makes life more accessible to those with invisible disabilities, by Gretchen Peterson. That would be a wonderful piece to read at this time. Again, looking at issues of workplace, which also, again, deals with this impact of COVID-19 and disability, older Black workers' resilience, navigating work and health risks with chronic conditions, by Kendra Jason. And looking at some of the pieces that we're kind of putting under what we might call our education series, because COVID ruined everything. I love that title. The impact of learning modalities and accommodations on students with disabilities during the COVID-19 pandemic, by Shauna Bendek. Definitely something very important for many of us to look at. It's not just happening in K-12 settings. We know it's happening in higher ed settings. The new normal for disabled students, Access, Inclusion, and COVID-19, by Paul Bones and Vanessa Ellison, and Rejecting a Pre-COVID-19 Normal, an auto-historia teora exploring disability justice reform in higher education, by Chimine Arfuso, and I apologize if I mispronounced that name. But as you can see in this particular part of the issue, we're really trying to address how COVID-19 has changed disability around issues of accessibility issues of the workplace and issues around education. If we could just pause on education for a moment, as someone who has two young kids, seeing what they have gone through during the pandemic. Because of my illness, we kept our kids virtual for 18 months. My son at the time was a kindergartner. It was very difficult to watch kindergarten happen on the screen. My daughter was in her third grade year, and more than anything, her emotional well-being was very challenged during this time. It was very hard to just interact with school friends and teachers through a screen versus having shared lunch and recess and art and music and more of those kind of typical activities you would have away from home. Fortunately, our kids were able to get vaccinated. And once they were and they've returned to school with a mask mandate and a vaccine mandate, things have been safe and comfortable. But those 18 to 19 months at home were so incredibly challenging for all of us sharing the home. But the well-being of the children was very difficult. It started out like it was something new and exciting. And it was like, oh, we get to do school from home. And we didn't know how long it was going to last. But once you do that for a little bit, it gets very tiresome. And I think we've seen in a lot of research the effects of this on children's well-being and to a degree their academic performance is something for all of us to be very mindful of.
Well, and as we both teach undergraduates, I think we're also really seeing that fatigue cropping up in the students. And I also am technically in this category. I did my thesis defense remotely. I was the very first in the department because it was scheduled for early April 2020, which was an interesting way to continue my professional development. And I also took courses remotely. And it did kind of start out like, oh, this is kind of nice. And one of the things that I experienced that you'll see pop up again and again in that education series of articles is that for disabled students, this was kind of the best. I had an awful time attending classes in person, especially because during my second year of grad school, I was undiagnosed. And I literally attended classes blindfolded because I had so much photosensitivity that I had to make sure that I couldn't see any fluorescent light. I would occasionally have to lay on the ground during class, which is very awkward, if nothing else. And I even collapsed on campus a few times. So moving remote for me was incredible, but for all of my peers, it was a very different and much more negative experience because for them, not being able to go to the office was 100% a loss. Whereas for me, I could at least take comfort in the fact that it was a lot easier on my body.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that. Teaching virtually has been a challenge. I love being in the classroom. I haven't been back in the classroom yet. I miss that tremendously. I continue to do the majority of my work through the screen. In some ways, it's allowed more work to occur. It cuts down on commute time. As someone who does commute an hour each way, it has allowed some of that time to come back. But at the same time, hiring has been different. We have a new dean and a new provost that I work closely with, and most of my interactions with them have occurred on the screen versus going to an in-person meeting and then saying, let's go grab lunch or a coffee. And that informal work that happens when you're on campus, those informal conversations with students or faculty or folks that you work with at the school, those are so critical to cultural campus development and departmental cultural work. And to not have that occurring has also been, I think it's been hard for students in lots of ways. And it's also been hard for faculty, especially if you're, you know, developing programs or creating things for students. I look forward to whatever our new normal is going to be whenever we reach that. But it's definitely been an interesting time in education. And I think something else that we have to think about, Sam, is for folks that are not able to get vaccinated because of age. I have colleagues that have young kids under 5. Watching them try to navigate working when daycare is not open because there's been an exposure, or they're, you know, and all of a sudden it's like everything has to shift and there's no consistency about if their child has a safe place to go. And obviously students that are parents that are dealing with this as well. I think that's also something that we have to kind of consider. And hopefully it's opening our eyes up to more consistent family care and the importance of providing that, especially for folks that don't have the opportunity to provide vaccines for their children yet.
Yeah, and I think that really brings us to what a lot of the articles in this special issue mention, which is what we can learn from this to keep things being more accessible in the future. I think it's fair to say we're all pretty tired of Zoom meetings, but they do have their place. And if we can learn from the things that we immediately had to change with the pivot to online education, if we can learn from how we made workplaces more safe and a little bit more flexible as we all tried to work through this collective trauma, maybe things can be more accessible long term. I think that's a very optimistic take, but I do like the thought of it.
I think you're right. I think there we have learned a lot from the pandemic, not only about disability and health and wellness, but to your point, work. Right? Is there a way to have a blend of in-person and virtual work? Will it make workers more happy? Will it still satisfy the needs of the economy? Will we still be able to produce what's needed to continue to move in our field? But at the same time, will we get some time back? Will that help us with our health and wellness? Will we be able to think about health and wellness in new ways if we're cutting down going to campus times for faculty and students? Will that help with, you know, other important parts of our lives, which include health and wellness? There is something to learn from this. As we've talked about, you know, the issue we've put together highlights so many important areas of how the pandemic has brought disability front and center. And at the same time as it's brought disability front and center, it's exposed so many parts of our social organizations that really need some very close attention because they're not holding us up in the ways we need them to, healthcare and education being two of them.
Well, I think a lot of those problems come back to so many of these social institutions have no wiggle room for the human element of we are not robots, we're not automatons, and sometimes people need time just to breathe. And that really makes me think of, we have the two final articles in this special issue, which are admittedly the emotionally draining reads, both of them. I'll just give a quick warning for that one. But isolation, fear, and anger, the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on pregnancy and childbirth by Beth Cavalier and Pamela Regis, and Hawaii to Hospice, Terminal Illness During a Global Pandemic by Sheila M. Katz and Danielle Hayworth. That last one, that article gets me every time I look it over. But they both touch on, this has been a very traumatic period for a lot of people in a lot of ways. And we're all going to have to slowly come to cope with the losses, with the anxiety, with the normal experiences that we never got, whether that be professional networking or having a quote unquote normal pregnancy experience. We've all lost a lot to COVID-19 and the mental health element of that and the invisible disability that mental health can become is really important to keep in mind.
I think that's well said. I really like how you mentioned these two pieces with the preface of trauma, because so much of what we've experienced through the pandemic has been very traumatizing. And both those two pieces highlight the way experiences of pregnancy, as well as hospice or death or loss, are traumatizing in some ways unto themselves, but how the pandemic has highlighted or made those experiences more traumatic because of what's been available or not available. And quite possibly those two pieces allow us to think about, if we're going through something that seems normal to human life, like having, you know, birth and death, how does a pandemic shape those experiences? How does it make them different? And in that difference, what does it now let us see, right? What is it open to us? And then how can we quite possibly make those experiences more humane and more accessible in ways that we haven't, you know, been able to reach those before?
And I hope that the instinct that people have had, especially just speaking from the teacher perspective. I think a lot of us have talked about cutting students a bit of slack over the pandemic, because there's a lot going on in the world, to put it mildly. And when that conversation comes up, I can't help but think, why weren't we cutting them slack before? Because personal lives can go wrong at any point in time, whether or not there's anything going wrong with society at large. You know, I lucked out that I had a department and a family and a partner who were all incredibly accommodating and thoughtful when my health took a complete nosedive. But that is not necessarily a universal experience. And one of the things the pandemic has forced everybody to do is try to think about, how can I be a little bit kinder? How can I make this a little bit more accessible? And how do I make this work for all of the people that I know and that are a part of, whether it be your workplace or your school or just your family? And I really hope that in that regard, the sociology of disability can really take a bigger part in people's mindsets, that it can be something that they think about. And I hope that this special edition can be part of that conversation. You know, use it in your classrooms, use it with your colleagues, try to think about how we can talk about this a little bit more concretely now that the pandemic has forced us all to reckon with it.
I think that's a great way to kind of pull this all together, right? Let's take these experiences and try to be more kind and humane with each other. And let's think about disability and health and illness and wellness in some new ways. Let's be a little bit gentler with ourselves and more gentle with others. I love that you highlighted our flexibility with students. And to your point, pre-pandemic, we might have been really strict about certain policies or rules around assignments or attendance. And then COVID comes and all of a sudden we're thinking about that a little bit differently. Well, maybe we should continue to think about that a little bit more differently, right? So many of our students, I think about the students I work with, school is not the only thing they're doing. And that's important to remember, right? Our social lives are complicated and the pandemic just complicated them even more. And for those that have experienced COVID-19, what are these new potential disabilities or chronic illnesses going to do to our social welfare? And then for those that we spend time with in the classroom and work with, how can we be more accommodating so we can move forward? And I think to your point, for those interested, reading the issue, bringing this subject into our classrooms, making it a part of our conversations at conferences, and when we share, you know, time with each other as sociologists, how can we be more present to this particular subject is going to be really important to advancing it. I think as we begin to close, it's super important that, one, we thank all of you for listening. Thank you for spending time with Sam and I today. This has been a subject very personal to both of us, as hopefully you can tell, but the issue matters too. The issue has been, we've spent a lot of time curating this issue. Those that have written for the issue have spent a lot of time getting their pieces ready to read. And we hope that you'll take the time to read and share the special edition with others. We would really like to thank Dr. Tiffany Taylor for all of her mentorship, her guidance, and energy towards the special issue. And of course, Dr. Cameron Lippard as the editor for the journal for this special issue, and all of our authors for their wonderful contributions to this project.
If this is something that you found even remotely interesting, you will find so much more than the actual pages of the special issue, and a lot of really good concrete suggestions of how we can be better moving forward. So thank you to everyone for being involved in this. And thank you, Marnie, for being a part of my dream to make a podcast episode accompanying an academic journal. This is just one more way that we can make academic conversations a little bit more accessible in a different way so that people can participate in a way that makes the most sense for them.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, and have a lovely day, everyone.